Hello, welcome to another edition of The Debate. I'm Kavitawi. In this debate, we're going to discuss Syria. The latest, the United States and Russian foreign ministers announced an agreement on the UN Security Council's draft resolution over Syria's chemical arsenal, with the Chapter 7 measure which could allow for a military strike if the Syrian government fails to abide. Any reference to Chapter 7, however, will require a new UN resolution. We'll also discuss the further fracturing among the opposition, including the SNC, its militants, and the al-Qaeda-linked Takfiri insurgents. And finally, will the destruction of Syrian chemical weapons pave the way for the demolition of Israel's weapons of mass destruction, including its nuclear weapons?
Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov says Moscow and Washington have finalized the draft document on a resolution on Syria. The document will later be submitted to the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons, which is tasked with verifying Syria's chemical weapons.
The resolution includes the agreement made in Geneva that any violation of these procedures by anybody will be investigated. The resolution calls on the opposition to cooperate with this process. If any chemical weapon is used by anybody, only then the Council will look at these cases again and will be ready to take action on Chapter 7.
The significance of the deal is that Moscow maintained its principal position over the resolution, while Western powers had to shy away from many of their demands. Russia also nailed its will, so in case of any violation by any party, there will be no use of force against Syria under Chapter 7 until the UN Security Council reconvenes and takes a new decision. Meanwhile, the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons is getting ready to send its inspectors to Syria to begin their mission. Russia has also said that Damascus will soon present the Organization of Prohibition of Chemical Weapons with additional data about its chemical arms. According to a Russian diplomat, the information includes stockpiles, weapon formulas, and types of ammunition that deliver them. The agreement came after the Russian foreign minister accused the U.S. of blackmailing Moscow over a UN resolution.
They want the Security Council to adopt a resolution with obligatory reference to Chapter 7, which envisages measures of pressure and violence in international law, including sanctions and possible use of force. And our American partners are even starting to blackmail us.
The foreign-backed opposition has already rejected the draft resolution.
The measures in the draft resolution are not imposed under Chapter 7. It says if parties do not adhere to the chemical weapons agreement, then other measures will be taken under Chapter 7. That means waiting for another agreement between Russia and the U.S. That would prolong the war. It's a weak resolution and does not meet the demands of the Syrian people. It is the result of a bargain.
Syria has always said that its chemical weapons are defensive and they're an alternate to Israel's weapons of mass destruction, including nuclear arsenal. With Damascus agreeing to put its chemical weapons under international control, it's now time for the world to take more robust action against Tel Aviv, the sole owner of nuclear weapons in the Middle East, to do the same and place its WMDs under international inspection and their eventual destruction.
Let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Debate. From the Answer Coalition Center, we have Brian Becker joining us from Washington. And we have journalist and commentator Richard Millett joining us from London. Gentlemen, welcome. Brian Becker, let me start with you on this draft resolution. Does it really make a difference if that Chapter 7 is going to be included, military action under that taken, if none of the veto-wielding Security Council members, Russia, China, the United States, France, and Britain, well, they can vote against that resolution? Not only that, the U.S. could act unilaterally if it wanted to, like in the past.
Well, the Obama administration and Secretary of State Kerry assert wrongly, I believe, that they have the right to carry out unilateral action against Syria. They said that they had that authority to do it before. They said they were consulting with Congress because they chose to consult with Congress, and then later they chose to go through the UN after Russia provided the an offer to have Syria ban chemical weapons. They say that they have this exceptional right. They call themselves the exceptional country, meaning apparently the country that can accept itself from all international norms and treaties and laws, which clearly the UN Charter does not give them that right, but they still assert that they have that right. for we, the people in the United States, and I think people around the world who have opposed a military strike on Syria, we say to them that they don't have that right, that that's wrong, that it's wrong politically, it's wrong morally, and it's certainly wrong legally.
Well, if this thing was to be included as a clause, it would have to be, Richard Miller, that the Syrian government would not be abiding by any of the standards that are set in the resolution. At the same time, many are hailing this to be a diplomatic victory in terms of a U.S.-Russian agreement that is making the Syrian government abide and submit its chemical weapons stockpile. Doesn't the threat of a war always lie on Syria? If the Chapter 7 was to occur, this would then give U.S. at any point, any time, to want to take advantage of the Chapter 7.
Well, then again, it would be vetoed, presumably, by Russia, who have made it clear that they don't want any military strike on Syria in any circumstances whatsoever. So we're going to see, this is a fairly weak resolution, to the extent that there isn't an end game vis-a-vis the actual civil war that's taking place. Instead of being killed by chemical weapons, as happened in Ghouta, that the innocent Syrians are going to be killed by standard military means, which is just as effective as what's happened in Ghouta. So this is a weak resolution, and it's going to be a busy year ahead. We've got Iran claiming it's going to stop enriching, possibly enriching uranium with a view to making a nuclear bomb. We've got this chemical demilitarization taking place in Syria. And both countries, Iran and Syria, in effect, are giving themselves more time to approach what they both really possibly want, is to crush the Syrian opposition in the opposition in Syria, and to eventually have a nuclear bomb in Iran. And as we know, they've threatened to wipe Israel off the map. So this is going to be a busy year ahead. It's either going to be an incredible diplomatic coup where Syria and Iran have come back into the fold of these governments have come back into the fold of normal civilization, or it's going to have left the West with egg on its face, many more deaths, civilian deaths in Syria, and Iran, with a nuclear bomb, which will both occurrences are going to leave the Middle East in even more catastrophe than it is at the moment.
Very well. Brian Becker, our guest Richard Miller, has a crystal ball that seems to indicate what's going to happen in the future vis-a-vis in terms of Iran and other factors that he stated there. But let me ask you this, Brian Becker, on this chemical weapons and the Syrian government submitting itself to inspection and eventually for its destruction. Do you think that that's going to pave the way for other countries that do have nuclear weapons, not to mention, even though in the case of Israel, they've undeclared it, that they will now be a possibility to have to submit their chemical weapons or even for inspection for their nuclear arsenal, let's say in form of signing on to the NPT?
Well, that's one of the... Yeah, I mean, that's one of the reasons Israel is so clearly unhappy about a peaceful potential settlement of the Syria crisis. One, they want to get rid of the Assad government. They were hoping for Western intervention because the so-called rebels, the armed groups who are having arms funneled to them by Saudi Arabia and Qatar and Turkey and coordinated by the CIA in Jordan, those forces can't win without Western intervention. But Israel has, as you may be suggesting, another overriding concern, which is that Israel has weapons of mass destruction. Not only does it have many nuclear weapons, not only does it have them and does not sign the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, not only does it not allow international atomic energy inspectors into Israel, but Israel also has biological weapons and Israel has chemical weapons. Israel was willing to sign the chemical weapons ban, but then never ratified that ban. So Israel has chemical weapons, biological weapons, nuclear weapons. It is the big possessor of weapons of mass destruction in the Middle East. It doesn't want any of the countries it targets for destruction, the governments it targets for regime change, to have those kind of weapons. But you see, President Obama, when he spoke at the United Nations, he said 98% of humanity had rejected chemical weapons. Well, he had to be thinking at that moment that the principal ally of the United States, the American extension of power in the Middle East, that is the Israeli government, possesses chemical weapons and biological weapons and nuclear weapons and will not get rid of them, nor does the U.S. want to put pressure on Israel. So what's happening is, inadvertently, as a consequence of the way this drama has unfolded, of course there will now be international attention, not just on Syria, not just on Egypt, which also has chemical weapons, but also on Israel. And why not have a regional ban on chemical weapons and weapons of mass destruction? Let's start with Israel, which possesses the greatest quantity of these weapons of mass destruction. That's what all of the world's going to start asking right now, and that's why the government in Israel is so against what's going on.
Well, let me ask that from our guest, Richard Millett. What do you think, Richard Millett? Why doesn't Israel take the lead in that?
Well, Mr. Becker lives in dreamland. If he hasn't seen what's been going on in the countries surrounding Israel, he doesn't read the newspapers or watch the news very much. In Israel, there is relative peace at the moment, and Israel has never used one of the weapons that was listed so clearly by Mr. Becker. Mr. Becker has no evidence that Israel has nuclear
weapons. Do they have them? Do they have them?
I mean, all the problems in the Middle East at the moment in Syria.
Do they have those weapons?
Well, you're so confident, Mr. Becker, you're so confident that they do, so you don't need to, I don't need to answer you. But if you look at the countries surrounding Israel, in Lebanon, in Syria, in Jordan, in Egypt, absolutely dreadful scenes we are seeing, and absolutely typically, Mr. Becker doesn't seem to care about any of these situations. He's solely focused, myopically, on Israel, and that's a very, very sad analysis. In my view, because there are more important things. Israel has never ever threatened to wipe another country off the map, like Iran has threatened to wipe Israel off the map. And in fact, Israel destroyed.
You must be joking. You must
Iraq
be joking.
In Iraq,
Israel
in 1982,
Israel destroyed West Bank a reactor and Gaza and Golan Heights
in Syria.
Byron Becker, go ahead.
I mean, Israel
destroyed
unilaterally
arrogates
to itself the right to bomb
for
Iraq in 1982. It bombed Syria. It seized the Golan Heights. It seized the Sinai. It seized the West Bank. It seized Golan Heights. The United Nations, if we want to talk about resolutions, passed Resolution 242 that insists that Israel give back land that it's been stolen from the Arab nation. That was 46 years ago. No enforcing resolution against that. But now you paint the picture in order to avoid the question of whether Israel does or does not have weapons of mass destruction. You say, well, Israel's intense. Its motivation is very pure. The others are the consummate evil, but Israel is really a peaceful entity. It doesn't answer the question, do they or do they not illegally possess weapons of mass destruction? You know the answer is yes.
Is the answer yes, Richard Millett?
Well, Israel hasn't used any of these, and Israel hasn't threatened to use any of these weapons, and these weapons are being used in the Middle East, in all the countries, or some of the countries surrounding Israel, but Mr. Becker doesn't seem to be so concerned. He doesn't seem to be so concerned about these other countries. All he's concerned about is Israel, where he's not sure whether these weapons exist, and Israel has never, ever intended to use any such weapons. Mr. Becker should really concentrate on other more serious situations than being so obsessed with Israel.
Okay, let's turn our focus back to Syria. Brian Becker, another...
It's not...
Go ahead, Brian Becker, and then we'll focus back to Syria. Go ahead.
It's not a question of obsession about Israel. I'm obsessed, if we want to be obsessed about anything, it's about U.S. policy in the Middle East. which, yes, gives Israel $3 billion each year or more in order to carry out perpetual occupation of Arab lands. But I'm also concerned about Saudi Arabia's role and Turkey's role and Qatar's role, because all of these organizations, along with the British and the French and the United States, have been sending large quantities of arms to armed organizations, rebel, so-called rebel groups, to foment civil war against a sovereign nation, a nation that the United States is at peace with. This is not legal activity. I'm not even talking about Israel here. Israel is part of it, but I'm talking about the U.S. policy, which has been to carry out regime change in Syria, as they did in Iraq, as they want to do in Iran, as they did in Libya. And then it's not about chemical weapons, it's not about democracy, it's not about human rights. It's because the United States wants to be the dominating power in this oil resource-rich part of the region, of the world.
Okay, Brian Becker, I wanted to ask you this question. This is a big blow that came to the SNC and, in turn, the Free Syrian Army this past week. And that was when these insurgent groups, 13 of them, including a powerful al-Qaeda-linked faction, they slammed the SNC, saying it no longer represents their interests. At the same time, you're having the al-Qaeda-linked Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant, ISIS, that have set a 48-hour deadline for the Free Syrian Army to surrender. That's an ultimatum that came into effect on Thursday. I can't even call it infighting between the FSA and these groups, because really that's almost another war from what it sounds like here, altogether spelling out a disaster for the SNC, for the FSA. What's going to happen based on this particular development, you think, in terms of the SNC itself, and of course what's going to happen on the ground?
The armed struggle going on between the different armed rebel groups in Syria is the natural consequence of the fact that they themselves are representatives of other forces. They are proxies. They are proxies of Saudi Arabia. They are proxies of Qatar. They are proxies of Turkey. Then the so-called moderate opposition is the proxy of the Western powers. Of course, all of the foreign forces that have their own national interests or perceived or stated national interests in Syria want their own armed groups, the ones that they fund, the ones that they finance, the ones that they arm, to do the work that they want to have done. It made it clear, I think, in the last week, that it was really only Western intervention, major military intervention by the United States, and they were hoping with Britain and France as well, that could have quickly turned the tide so that the Western proxies could have gotten the upper hand in the Syrian battlefield. That was the basic strategy of Obama and Kerry before they were stopped in their tracks by both domestic and global opposition. But it shows that the opposition in Syria is not viable. It really is just an extension of foreign powers, even though, of course, many Syrians will have legitimate, valid criticisms against the Assad government. But the armed groups are really representing those who give them their arms and give them their money. And I think that's the reason this opposition has fractured.
Well, that's very confusing. Richard Millard, here we have the French Foreign Minister, Laurent Fabio, saying that he hopes the five permanent members of the UN Security Council will be able to set a date on Friday for the so-called Geneva II peace talks, were it to happen. And at the same time, you have countries that are arming and funding, Western countries arming and funding these groups on the ground. Doesn't quite go together if they want any type of talks to happen. Can you explain that to us?
I don't know. I don't think it's true that these, as you say, these Western countries are backing whatever is in the opposition in Syria militarily. I don't think that these countries are. I think there is some sort of humanitarian aid, but it's very far from military intervention that you imply. What we've seen here is the Arab Spring that hasn't been quite a spring in Egypt, in Tunisia, in Libya, in Syria. We've seen that the opposition has mainly been Islamists wanting to impose an Islamist ideology on the country. And Mr. Becker's analysis, once again, is a complete joke. For him to blame the West, as he always seems to be doing, and not actually have a closer look at the region and seeing what is happening here, once again, is laughable. You can't blame everyone else except the actual, as you just named, al-Qaeda and all the Islamist terrorist groups groups that are actually hijacking what started out as an Arab Spring and is now turning into one of the deepest, darkest winters.
Who's providing the money to these groups, Richard Millett?
Well, the groups, I should imagine that Al-Qaeda is well funded, and there are some extremely wealthy individuals that are backing. Well, I can't name you, but originally we know that Al-Qaeda was funded very heavily by one Osama bin Laden. And there are some very, very wealthy backers out there who continue to back the Al-Nusra Front and all the Al-Qaeda affiliates wherever they are, as we've seen, including the terrorist attack recently in a shopping mall in Nairobi, Kenya.
Brian Becker, same question to you, if you can explain that to Richard Miller in terms of who's backing them.
I mean, there should be no confusion. It's not just, quote, wealthy individuals. I mean, it's Saudi Arabia, the Saudi monarchy, which is trying to overthrow the Assad government, which is trying to also weaken the armed resistance and civil resistance forces in Lebanon as part of its efforts regionally to undermine influence of those who have been resisting Western imperialism and colonialism and who are in solidarity or in some sort of alliance, either military or diplomatic, with Iran. The United States, the Western forces, have used Saudi Arabia, and they haven't cared too much the fact that Saudi Arabia is, in fact, arming the most extreme Al-Qaeda forces in Syria because they have a bigger agenda. And they don't care so much who the foot soldiers are. They want the bigger agenda to be achieved. What is that bigger agenda? Destroy all independent nationalist governments in the Arab world and in the Middle East. So that means destroying the Syrian government, then destroying or reorganizing the constellation of forces in Lebanon, and ultimately to isolate Iran so that the U.S. can carry out what it has been determined to do since 1979, which is to carry out regime change against the Islamic Republic of Iran. Again, why? Not because the United States loves democracy, because the United States imposed the Shah of Iran on the Iranian people, starting with the coup in 1953, the British CIA coup. And then they had 26 years of the most brutal dictatorship under the Shah. The U.S. was very happy about that government, not because it was anti-democratic, but because it was a proxy. It was an extension of American power in a very important region of the world where two-thirds of the world's oil is. The big picture is the United States is willing to make an alliance with Saudi Arabia, which has a narrower regional interest, but the U.S. is willing to make an alliance with them in order to carry out their fundamental objective, which is to overthrow Syria and then overthrow the Iranian government. It's part of a regional plan. We can't think of it as like the American government, the French government, the British government, the former colonizers of the Middle East, those who have imposed dictatorships on the Middle East, suddenly have a tender spot in their hearts for the needs of Arab or Middle Eastern peoples for democracy. That's not what's driving their foreign policy.
Very well. We're going to have to leave it there. From Answer Coalition, Brian Becker was talking to us there from Washington, and journalist and commentator Richard Millett spoke to us from London. And thank you for watching another edition of The Debate. From Mikko Tahwe, entire team in the capital, Tehran, it's goodbye.